it's time for a bonus episode. I love episodes of theater. We're going off the beaten path. We're off.
Hey, dudes.
Hey, dudes.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How
I'm
are
doing
you?
Pretty good. I mean,
I'm good.
Yeah.
It's a good energy. I feel like our energy for Stoppard was a little lacking, and maybe we could have gone a little deeper, but we had fun. We had a good time.
Yeah, we were in the middle of stuff and finishing stuff up, both collectively and individually.
I think we might have some listeners who are like really big Arcadia stans who listen to that episode and are like, they didn't even scratch
CJ
the
is wrong. Yeah.
CJ is
Well, I just don't think we got too deep. We ended up debating some things that were kind of surface level, which is good. That's what we're doing. It's a macro look thing. But I want to start this episode right. I want to ask y'all a question.
Oh.
Legitimately, what are your, from past or present, what are your favorite sketch comedy shows? Or like things surrounding sketch comedy, because obviously we've all been a part of the Los Angeles-based sketch comedy competition Serial Killers, which is super fun, but I want to know, like, especially because we're talking about Gilliam today, I want to know what your ultimates were. I grew up on Mad TV and I was a big Kids in the Hall kid. More recently I really loved that Mitchell and Webb look. Mm-hmm. Was really fun. One, and then there's that show, I Think You Should Leave, I think it's what it's called. It's
yes. On, yes, which is great. Yes.
Netflix, which I love.
Really underrated. I was a Python stan. Like, that's where it all started with me.
Yeah.
And it was primarily because, and this is dating myself real bad, but in the late 80s, MTV started their... doing this thing called British Invasion Hour, and every night at 11 o'clock it was an episode of Monty Python followed by an episode of The Young Ones. And if you've never watched The Young Ones, it was a crazy British sitcom. And so that was my thing. I had seen Life of Brian before that. I had seen Holy Grail before that, certainly. I'm probably meaning a life. But I hadn't really dove deep into the show. And then as I was getting into high school-ish, Kids in the Hall came out. And they were huge. They were the heir apparent in a lot of ways. So those were the two big ones for me.
What about you, Sage?
I was thinking about like kind of how lucky I was to grow up when I did with Nickelodeon, because I watched a shit ton of All That and Roundhouse.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like, so it was always fun watching sketch comedy by people your own age doing it. I watched a lot of In Living Color growing up.
All That was huge for
me.
And I don't know that I don't know that you could call this sketch comedy, but you mentioned Mitchell and Webb. I have probably seen Peep Show all the way through at least 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, not technically sketch, but still, they took that type of comedy and put it into sketch, which is that Mitchell and Webb look, and it rules. That show rules.
They're fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, a bit of Fry and Lori. I've watched a bit of. I haven't watched a ton of it, but I think that was sketch.
Yeah. The Mighty Boosh.
Have your older... Mighty Boosh, of course. And then you have your older, you know, more American kind of variety hour type sketch stuff. You know, even The Muppet Show was basically a sketch
show. Lots of Muppet Show in my life.
Yeah. All that, I'm saying all this because today we're talking about a Terry Gilliam film, and Gilliam is just so ingrained. I mean, Python is such a huge part of that conversation. Yeah. And I know we're going to talk Python. I'm probably going to make you rank those. We'll see. But, because I don't want to rank all the Gilliams, but at least, you know, the 3 main Python movies. Welcome to Theater, theater podcast for theater nerds. Made by 3 theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And as always, to cleanse our palate between playwrights, we offer you another bonus episode of Theater and Stuff, where we pick theater adjacent things and nerd out all over them.
Yeah.
So this week is a Scott's pick. Scott, what'd you choose and why?
I choose. That's how this is going to go this whole episode.
Yeah, it's fine.
No, I chose Terry Gilliam's Brazil, For a couple of reasons. It had come up in conversation a lot recently.
Yeah.
I think they just covered
Stoppard.
And then because Stoppard wrote it, I'm like, I had another idea and I'm going to save it. And you guys are going to love it. And you're going to love me next season when we do my first Scott's pick next season. But putting that on hold to do this, and A, it gave us all a chance to hang out and eat some exotic pizza and watch the movie.
Fucking together. Lucifers. We need to get them to sponsor this podcast.
Yeah, no shit, dude. Like every almost
every
time
we watch something.
It's like, let's order some Lucifers. Let's do a lamb pizza.
It's so good.
Oh, yeah, that pumpkin.
We did a prosciutto pumpkin moment.
Oh my God.
Very festive.
Yeah. Okay, we're not sponsored. We're not sponsored.
Not sponsored.
Not sponsored. Digressions. Okay. Anyway, so that it's a great reason to choose it, and it was fun to kick it. It was fun to watch together. CJ did sleep through a bit of it. We started it a little late. There was a bit of pot smoking involved, so I understood.
I rewatched it last night, though.
She rewatched it
all as well. I wasn't giving you a hard time. I was just saying, like, it was a good enough night. We were comfortable enough that CJ could pass out, and it was all.
Yeah. I was sleepy.
You're sleepy.
Well, we just seen Tar that day too.
We just had 3 hours of Tar, so it was a big movie day for little CJ.
Oh, heavy, yeah.
Yeah. And we'll give our Tar takes later, but because I enjoyed it thoroughly. But
me too.
This movie is a movie that lives in so much of the pop culture that we inhale, and we don't even realize it.
People
right?
do not realize yet.
So much so that it shows up, the theme from this shows up in a Star Wars film. So we'll get into all of that. But first, I would like to know what it's about from our very own Sajay, Christine Joy.
Christine.
Breakdown.
CJ's Breakdown.
Sam Lowry, who often daydreams of himself with cum gutters in shiny wings and rescuing a beautiful damsel in distress, is, in reality, an unhappy pencil pusher. He gets caught up in an investigation of a wrongful death of a supposed terrorist, and absolutely everything goes to colorful, well-choreographed shit. Will Sam escape? Will he ever find the woman of his dreams? It's a loose rehash of 1984, so take a wild guess.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. I wouldn't call it a loose rehash of 1984. I would call it something thematically similar.
All right.
But you could say that about Brave New World. You could say that about 100 other things. But I agree. Yeah, it lives in the same vein. But weirdly, the movie 1984...
With John Hurt,
which came out what year?
The year in 1984.
It came out in 1984. So it came out a year before this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? So, but there are some, when you watch the movies, there are definitely some production elements that are similar.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people have said, like, well, he was taking things from that film. And I disagree, because I think he's circling things that are involved in that production design, but he's doing something very different. And that's a different take.
I've only ever read the book. I've never seen the movie.
Sure.
It's okay. It's dreary to be sure.
It is dreary.
I read the book.
I read the book too. I'm just saying.
The movie's slow and dark and dreary. Yeah.
I think also, like, he wouldn't have seen anything. You know, it's like the conspiracy theory about Dark Side of the Moon. Like, they weren't screening Wizard of Oz and
composing so he wouldn't have directly along with it.
Yeah, he was already well into production when that movie came out. So, you know.
Since then, a lot of things have pulled from this. It's a very British film, even though Gilliam himself is actually not British.
He is now, but no, at the time
sure.
he was.
But I mean, he's born in Minnesota, raised in Los Angeles.
Minnesota, raised
in Los Angeles, and then moves out, I think in his 20s, And according to his IMDb page, which I'm 90% sure he wrote. in fact, let me just read it to you because it's
quite funny. Yeah,
Terry Gilliam was born near Medicine Lake, Minnesota. When he was 12, his family moved to Los Angeles, where he became a fan of Mad Magazine. In his early 20s, he was often stopped by the police, who suspected him of being a drug addict. And Gilliam had to explain that he worked in advertising. In the political turmoil in the 60s, Gilliam feared he would become a terrorist and decided to leave the USA. He moved to England and landed a job on the children's television show Do Not Adjust Your Set as an animator. There he met Meat, his future, that's what it says, he met Meat, his future collaborators in Monty Python, Terry Jones, Eric Idle, and Michael Palin.
Yeah.
In 2006, he renounced his American citizenship. So the part that I think sounds like he wrote it a little bit, which, you know, most people do write their IMDb, but, you know, he was suspected of being the police suspected him of being a drug addict so much that he had explained that he worked in advertising. And then because of the political turmoil, he feared he would become a terrorist. So he moved to
and I've seen and read like full interviews where he goes in depth about that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that shook him was, he was a long haired hippie and he would like daily get thrown up against a wall by cops. And he'd be like, I'm in advertising. I am an art student that is now in advertising. And then it dawned on him. He's like, holy shit. What if I was black? What if I was Hispanic? How fucking miserable that is. Like, it sort of dawned on him and he started getting, he was very much radicalized and very much a person of his time. And so decided to come to England and become an animator.
But then he starts, he gets a little bit of fame because Monty Python's Flying Circus comes out, sort of the ultimate British sketch show at the time, and he does all of those bizarre little animation things, which I loved as a kid.
It really solidified it as something more than just a sketch show. It would link things together and create this flow, and people had never... It had always been a host who would come out and introduce the next sketch. And they were like, no, this is all going to freak you out.
I was a really big fan of... Now, this is... Since we're at the Monty Python point, I do want to ask y'all, what your favorite Monty Pythons are. But I was into the sketches as well. I was into Flying Circus. I still own the Hollywood Bowl Live Monty Python on VHS, which is
really
fantastic.
Yeah.
But my favorite one is their film of sketches called And Now for Something Completely Different. And it's genius. It has all of their best Flying Circus sketches. It has the lumberjack song. It has
the parrot sketch.
That's the same one, technically. In the movie, they make it the same sketch.
Oh, right.
So the guy gets so angry about the parrot that he's like, you know what? I never wanted to own a pet shop. I always wanted to be a lumberjack, and it turns into the lumberjack song, which is hilarious. But those are two separate sketches. But it like sort of draws them all together almost as like one long movie sketch. And I was obsessed with that. But it has some of the best animation in it. It's
because he had a budget.
They go really far with it.
Yeah.
And a lot of things getting squashed by feet with a fart sound, that kind of junk, a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I, I love that. I love the other three, but I have one that's my favorite below. If we're not counting that as a movie, if there's the other three, then I have a favorite. And then the other two, I want to know what y'all's are because.
Bailey loves ranking shit.
I love ranking shit.
Bailey loves ranking shit.
I do. So I want to know.
More than he loves either CJ or myself.
No, that's not true. I love CJ much more. CJ, do me a favor.
Yeah.
No, Scott, you're close, though. CJ, what are your Monty Pythons? Do you know Monty Python, the movies?
Well, I like to make the Family Guy joke when people ask me about Monty Python. I say, I'm a girl. I don't like Monty Python.
Oh, interesting.
I've seen the Grail movie. That's it. And then I saw Spamalot when it was in L.A. on tour, when it was first on tour, because one of my teachers, he was my Shakespeare and one of my dialect teachers at conservatory, Christopher Gurr was his name, was the coconut guy on tour.
That's Terry Gilliam in the movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
So like, it was never played in my house when I was growing up. And then I think I watched the Holy Grail one at Scott's place probably over a decade ago.
Got it.
That is it.
So that's the one you know. So yeah. The one I thought you would have known just because it's a very, I feel like it's a very CJ type movie, is Life of Brian.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, what are your rankings of Monty Pythons? I know you know them.
Yes, without question, Life of Brian is my number one. And now we should do that next season, and that'll be my second Scott pick next season.
Perfect.
All right.
Because you'll dig
I'm
it
in.
The most. I think it's legitimately one of the great satires ever.
One of the great religious satires, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you know, how it goes after... it goes after followers of faiths and belief systems more than it goes out, but there's some pretty hilarious shit in it.
Yeah.
Next up, I would do Holy Grail. Then I would do Now for Something Completely Different. And then I would do Meaning of Life. Meaning of Life is fun, but
it's kind of sketchy
movie.
Too. Yeah,
it is a sketch movie. Yeah. There's a vague through line through it, but
yeah.
And there's some great moments in it, you know. Salmon mousse.
My rankings would be, and now for something completely different at the top, but then it would be Holy Grail. I mean, that's just the one. That's like the one that I just know through and through. I know every line from it. I know every moment. And then probably Life of Brian and then Meaning of Life. Those two are kind of on the same plane for me because I like parts of both of them a lot. And then there's other parts that I actually like fast forward through. Like, I actually think maybe now... rewatching Meaning of Life, I would get more out of it. But the first sketch in Meaning of Life where they're like accountants, but they're like pirates.
Yeah.
And it's like two buildings like doing pirates against it. Like that whole, like, doesn't...
And that's
it, like,
all Gilliam. That's
I know, a, right. Yeah. It's very Gilliam, but like, didn't click for me as a kid.
Yeah.
Right?
No,
I was like, I don't know what he's doing here. But that is very Brazil.
Very
that
Brazil.
That is a very Brazil thing. Now, so... this kind of takes us in there, is that the Brazil in general has a very Gilliam look to it. All these like, and you see it in all of it, in a lot of his other work too, but this is sort of the epitome in my opinion where, and I learned a lot about this through the Searching for Don Quixote or whatever that documentary is called.
Oh,
about the man of but
Lost in La Mancha.
You're right. Lost in La Mancha, which is about
That's
a
good title.
It is, but it's about a failed Don Quixote movie he was making with Johnny Depp that just kept not happening and kept not happening. He finally put it out. It's his last film credit right now. He finally put it out with Adam Driver, and it's bad. I mean, it's like fine, but it's just not very Gilliam. It's just like kind of boring and has a low budget, and it's not great. But he does this thing that he talks a lot about in Lost in La Mancha, which is like he makes things... perspectively feel really big or really small or really far away or really just by like giving us a crazy camera angle and putting on a weird lens, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that, and Brazil really taps into that, which is super fun. But that's the nerdy like film shit that we don't have to get into. Do you know other Gilliam films, CJ?
I mean, not off the top of my head. I'm not good at this director.
I'm
going to
list
films, please.
Yeah. I'm going to list a few for you that I think you might know.
All right.
So we have the Monty Pythons, obviously, and then we have Time Bandits. Do you know Time Bandits?
No.
Okay, it's one of the greats.
You'll dig like, it the most. You'll dig it the most.
Super fun. And then he has Adventures of Baron Munchausen is one of my favorites, but he just screenplays that. But then. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes, it's been a while, but yes.
But that's him. Tideland, you probably haven't seen. Did you ever see Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus?
I didn't, but I remember it being all over the TV. Like,
yeah, because it was Heath Ledger's final performance.
That's right. That's
and
right.
He
didn't
actually passed away while they were shooting it. And so Colin Farrell and Johnny Depp and Jude Law finished the movie as him in the alternate reality. And I love that movie. I know a lot of people who think it's absolute trash.
No,
it's about traveling it's about tragedians, like a traveling pageant wagon putting up theater. But when you go inside it's like a real world that you go into, so it's theater.
Cool.
It's very theater based and I love it. We'll cover it next season.
I'm writing all
this
down.
And then he also did something you probably haven't heard of. It's called The Zero Theorem. It's a Christoph Waltz. It was sort of him.
It's a vague kind of continuation in the same world as Brazil.
Sure.
Vague. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's very dystopian, but yeah. It sort of.
And then 12 Monkeys. 12 Monkeys is the other one that I feel like you would maybe know.
Oh, Fisher King. You didn't mention Fisher King.
Oh, I'm looking at his writing credits. That's why. Okay. Sorry. Here's a couple that you might definitely know. Fisher King, which we all watched together, didn't we? Am I crazy?
No.
I watched that with somebody recently. 12 Monkeys. And then The Brothers Grimm. Have you ever seen the movies, the movie The Brothers Grimm with Matt Damon?
No.
And I think the other one is Heath Ledger.
Is Heath Ledger.
Yeah. Oh, how was it?
It's okay. It's got its moments. It's got some.
Is it just about how actually creepy all those fairy tales are?
Yes.
Like kinda, how scary they actually are.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about what if the Grimm brothers were like traveling con artists who like make up these fairy tales and stuff, but then what if all the fairy tales came true?
Right.
And it's to them, right? And they become like Van Helsing type characters. It is. It is not good, to be clear, but it's Gilliam-y and it's weird and it's kind of fun in the right ways, but it's definitely like on the lower end of his shit.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that's like, oh, that's streaming. Let me get high and put this on.
What? Yeah.
You're not going to be processing it.
I have a question. The Monty Python guys, isn't one of them kind of a complicated public figure now because he went like crazy right wing?
No, none of them have gone crazy right wing. But
I thought
Cleese,
I heard that.
Cleese and Gilliam have both defended J.K. Rowling.
In wrong times. Like the way they did it was at the wrong time.
Right.
All right, all right.
And they haven't stuck to it deeply like
That's
some
good.
Have. Like Hagrid, what's his name?
Robbie
definitely like held on to it till the end. Was
did
defending.
He really?
Oh,
oh I
yeah.
didn't know that. That's
he's
upsetting.
One of the worst. No, he's the worst one. But they all did. They all sort of like stepped out. Like, no, you know, whatever. But Cleese has stepped back from it.
Yeah, because Cleese's argument really wasn't a defense of her position so much as a defense of her as a person against, because she got all those death threats,
right?
Yeah. And that was one of the things.
He came out as a friend talking about, and so it's just it's all tough. It's all tough. We don't have to litigate it here, but
no. I was just curious.
Yeah, it's all tough, but like you know, Cleese talk Cleese for 5 seconds. I mean, Fawlty Towers is a huge piece of my childhood.
Oh, sure.
And it's only like 2 seasons and a Christmas special or something, or like 3 seasons, right? It's like super short, but it's one of them. Anyway, John Cleese. Also, he's Q in the Pierce Brosnan movies.
Yeah,
Pierce Brosnan, James Bond. I like those movies. They're fun.
Yeah.
You don't like them?
Yeah, I think the Daniel Craig ones best out of all of
them.
Yeah,
they're the best. Those are the best. But like, Pierce Brosnan ones are fun. They're a good time.
Yeah.
GoldenEye's fun. Okay. What else, Gilliam? Is there anything else specifically Gilliam y'all want to say before we move on?
Well, just to go back real quick, and the pebble in the pond that Brazil was because of his sort of. And he's manic. Like, if you ever see him interviewed, like, he's even as an old man, he's just kind of this manic energy, which you could feel permeate through. But just the amount of influence that he had, and immediately, like, within 2 years, then you start seeing Tim Burton go, oh, yeah. Now he's riffing on expressionism and Victorian imagery and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But he puts it through such a unique filter that, you know, this movie is like a film nerd, you know, rallying point. Like this
sure.
is where people like really like, cause in many ways it's just, you know, people like it's confusing and it's like, well, but it's also clear as a bell, like in terms of what he's talking about and what he's saying, it's all very visual, which I thought was the most interesting thing about the pairing of Stoppard in this, that Stoppard is there's not a lot of dialogue or speeches or anything like that, but everything that's there is clear as a bell in terms of what they're saying and doing.
Yeah. There's one more Gilliam thing I thought was extremely interesting, which, and obviously we'll be talking about him a lot more the rest of this episode, but the story of how this movie sort of became seen, because yes. it wasn't really going to be seen, no. which I think is super interesting. So
that was one of my big questions. How was this received when it first came out?
Yeah. So the best way to start that story is that he, this is his, okay. So this is considered the, okay.
Deep breath.
It's complicated.
I have like four things to say. Okay, so the first part of it is that he does this movie to him is very important. He has a lot to say with this film, and we can get into that in a second. But it's the second of a trilogy. The first one being Time Bandits, the third one being Adventures of Baron von Munchausen, which he calls his trilogy of imagination. And he sort of continues that with Dr. Parnassus, and he's always dealing with imagination.
Yeah.
He always is. But these three, he really considers as this thing. And so he was very passionate about this movie, but it wasn't going to be seen by a lot of people. He's still not like this massive director. Like Time Bandits does well, Holy Grail does well, but like he's not considered like the guy yet, right? And so he is supposed to do a film class at USC. And he brings it in and he's like, you know what? I'm going to like bring in the movie and I'm going to show the movie and like invite people, like critics to see it, because like I know I'm not going to have another chance to show this. They're not mm-hmm. giving me a chance to show it. So he apparently told the teacher he was going to be doing that, and the teacher told the kids, and the kids started advertising that it was a free thing, and the studios found out about it because of the advertisements. So they, like, literally, he's, like, in there talking to him, and the studio execs are calling him, like, no, you can't show it, you can't do this. And finally, he, like, fights them tooth and nail, and finally he's like, let me show a clip. And they're like, okay, a clip. You can show a clip. Fine. For no money, you know, they can see a clip. He goes, great. He goes and he shows the whole movie. and his cut, like, his original cut, and he's like, this is it. And they go nuts. He ends up showing, nobody finds out, he ends up showing it for 2 weeks straight at the on campus, and just starts inviting critics.
Critics start
coming and seeing it, and at some point Critics' Choice, you know, he gets best picture of the year, and it's just like, it's just rad. It's just cool.
Yeah.
It's cool that it was kind of punk for him to just be like, well, fuck
it
you.
It was, and it anyway. Was, we should say it was the studio, too, that he delivered his cut. The studio was like, nah, it's got to have a happy ending. So there was a huge battle about that. And so he was like, I need to, if I can get this in the right hand. So it ends up winning, like, the LA Film Critic, you know, best film in the
But it was
world.
His cut, not the
it
studio's.
It was his cut, right.
That
and then
won
there was
all that, stuff.
Yeah, and what we saw was ultimately the compromised.
The compromised cut. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I thought that was all very interesting.
Cool as fuck.
Should we talk cast? Do you guys want to talk themes?
Hell
you want to talk through the show?
I
want to
talk cast. I just was excited about the old standards, and I mean, they're mostly Brits, that it was just fun to see them as young men in something.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, let's go through the cast.
Yeah.
Let's start at the top. Let's do JP, Jonathan Pryce, as Sam Lowry.
Yeah.
He's always sounded that way. I loved it.
I think he's
also
well-spawned.
He's also in Baron von Munchausen as sort of like the villain. He's great.
Yes.
Oh,
and then
right.
He ended up being in Don Quixote too.
Yes. Right. He ends up playing Don Quixote. Don Quixote.
But yeah, I mean, he was an interesting choice that, you know, the studio was just like, what?
He's also in Tomorrow Never Dies, 007, Pierce Brosnan.
That's
keep going.
Right.
Was he known kind of as like a serious guy back then? Because he's almost kind of like
by this
funny
point,
and goofy in this at times.
By this point, he's already got.
Movie.
By this point, he's already got a Tony and two Olivier Awards.
Holy
yeah.
shit! Okay.
Yeah, he's like he is a theater dude. He's known as a theater dude.
He does a lot of like TV movies and stuff, but yeah, he's theater through and through. And then I think his first major film is a movie I watched a lot as a kid, which is the Disney made, even though it doesn't feel like it, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He's Mr. Dark. He's
yes.
the bad guy in it.
Yes.
And he's fantastic. He's creepy. It's
a
scary movie.
Creepy as shit.
It's kind of weirdly the same plot as Dr. Sleep. The Sequel of The Shining.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic. It's a fantastic film.
In 2005, I saw him on Broadway opposite Norbert Leo Butz in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. He'd started when John Lithgow had left.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And he was, everyone was still there. Joanna Gleason was still there. There was a bunch of like old Broadway folks in that show, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and go ahead.
I was just going to say his casting was like, even like Tom Cruise had kind of auditioned for it even. And originally, the original idea was that it was a young man.
It was a young man. Yeah. And this is Tom Cruise circa Risky
Business.
This is before Tom Cruise is anywhere. Yeah. This is like him. This is him doing Legend. This is Tom Cruise in early Tom Cruise. Yeah.
Yeah. He's coming up. But, and so then he had known Jonathan Pryce for a long time and then had seen his audition. He's like, that's the answer. It's not a young dude. It's a middle-aged dude who's trying to lay low in this fucked up world, and he just nailed it. I also got to give credit. Like, he's physically so funny in this. Like,
he is, yeah.
Just the way he kind of gets tossed about and bumbles
about.
Theater
people doing movies. Well, like, right?
And he's good at playing
people on camera.
He's good at playing fuddy-duddy. Right. Sure. But like then when he's like going through all the shit and he's like, oh, no. But he also looks insane as the angel when he's flying around in his dreams. He doesn't look cool. I know he thinks he looks cool.
Yes.
But he looks insane. And it's like on purpose. Like it all works. And he's very aware physically of what he's doing, especially with his face.
No,
he's doing a lot of great face acting. Yeah. I also really love him in so much shit. Obviously, he's had a resurgence with Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Yes,
and things like this.
He's great in The Two Popes.
Yeah, The Two Popes. He got a nom
for that. It's really good. Yeah, he did.
We talked about him a little bit when we talked Miss Saigon. There was some like problem things surrounding that and how he handled being called out for the yellow face and things. He has also done brown face as Juan Perón in the Evita movie.
Yeesh.
He's also, he's done.
Boy, he was in that movie.
Stuff.
I saw it in theaters, but that's about it.
He's her husband. He's Perón. He's the dude. Yeah, he and Madonna. Mm. Interesting. But then, you know, he's had some solid roles. I've brought up Stigmata on this podcast a few times. He's in Ronin with De Niro, actually.
Yeah.
But okay, so let's move on to DeLovely. I forget he's in that. And he's in the Pirates movies. He's Swan. He's what's her name's dad? Keira Knightley's dad.
Yeah, that's right.
Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Yeah. I always forget about that. I think he's in like fucking all of them too, which is insane.
I'm sure he's crying all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
Right. And he's in like the G.I. Joe movies and like we're just like, what are you doing? And making money, I guess. All right.
Yes, making some fucking money.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. All that to say, we still like JP. He's got some, you know.
Yeah.
We like him. Yeah. Okay. Kim Greist or Greist. I think it's Greist.
It's Greist.
And it's Jill Layton. She plays Jill Layton. She's the sort of manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah.
That
she reminded me of Alison
sort of
Pill.
Subvert. Oh, yeah. I love Alison Pill.
I do too. Yeah. But like, she just looked like her and like, especially when she's playing tough badass, driving the Mad Max truck, she reminded me of her.
Yeah. She's so 80s to me. She's so like Total Recall. She's so, you know, like Sharon Stone.
It's the haircut.
Total Recall. Like it, yeah, I like it. Thoughts?
Yeah,
she's also in Manhunter, which we brought up recently.
Yeah. She didn't do a lot after this. Apparently, she just wasn't great on set. Yeah, not that she was problematic, but that she wasn't giving the performance that he wanted and what he had seen in an audition. And he had originally wanted to use Ellen Barkin, who would have been perfect at this point.
I'm 99% sure she's the mom in Homeward Bound.
With the cat and the two dogs?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
The Incredible Journey remake.
VHS.
Yeah, I did too. I'm pretty sure that's her. She's the mom in that and the sequel, Lost in San Francisco, which is better. It's probably not. But she does, you know, since then she's just done like bit shit. Like she was on a Wonderful World of Disney called H.E. Double Hockey Sticks that I remember pretty well from 1999. She was Marie Antoinette. Besides that, like, you know, an episode of X-Files, an episode of Judging Amy. She was in a movie called Shriek, If You Know What I Did Last Friday the 13th.
Huh.
Yeah.
Sounds like a bad spoof movie. Anyway, she's pass or fail.
Oh, I think she's a pass in this. I like her.
Yeah, she passes, yeah.
She also has to play two completely different characters in it, too, which is fun.
Yeah. True. Let's talk about that just for a second, because I don't want to forget about it. Let's talk about this manic pixie dream girl thing. Because in my opinion, this movie does a really good job of subverting that and twisting it and being like, you're an idiot for thinking that about her by the end of it. Right? Or is it not that?
I don't know. For me personally, I thought she was a manic pixie dream girl in two different versions that people attracted to her would like to see her as.
Either a woman driving a big old truck and being like, fuck
with
you.
With a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, being a badass, shooting guns.
Yeah.
And then also floating in a box, and you can kind of see her nipples if you look closely enough at her dress.
Sure. Yeah, and I guess maybe that's what it is. But by the end of it, the way they treat her and the way they treat him and the way he is a creep towards her is, which he is. It's not romantic. I don't think we can argue
it's weird.
That. Yeah.
No,
it's weird.
It's
the whole time the way he treats her is weird.
Which I think
it's
is
definitely
the point.
A
yeah.
dream. It's definitely
yes.
I
mean, he kidnaps
him projecting,
her.
Projecting. Yeah.
Basically. Yep. So like, I think it does.
And
a good
he
job
stalks
of not,
her.
He and he stalks her.
He takes a job to find out about where.
I just think it would be easy to watch this movie and be like, ugh, manic pixie dream girl stereotype. And I'm like, I think it's subverting it before the manic pixie dream girl even exists. Like, we haven't even met that yet. Like, the 80s create it, sort of.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, in film, at least.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, you know, I mean, Six and Kids, you know, the John Hughes is very that.
Very
but,
much.
Like, of it all, but, like, I think the 90s really go. Is where we hit it really hard. So the fact that he's sort of subverting that before that is interesting to me. That's all.
And that she's the one that is awake. That she's the one that's aware that there is that.
Well, and she's part of the resistance in some ways, right? She's the one who like gets what's going on. She's like, no, dude, there's not terrorists. Have you ever met a fucking terrorist? She asked him that at one point. That's a great scene where she's like, have you ever met one of these terrorists?
Yeah.
And he's like, well.
Yeah, because we never really know who the terrorists are.
But that's the thing. What I think the movie is saying, and this is getting into a bigger piece, is that I think it is the government blowing shit up. And
it's
they're just saying they're creating fear. It's creating chaos. It's being like there's terrorists and it's what's happening now, literally.
To distract, yes.
I got the feeling that it was Tuttle's group that was doing it. No? Or I guess they leave it open.
No, I don't think so. I get
why Tuttle
as
a hero in a lot of ways.
Tuttle is the one, that's the thing.
If you're bombing an unjust government, doesn't that kind of weirdly make you the hero in that kind of world anyway?
Sure, but
which is why
I don't think that that's
it
what
him.
Maybe. That's I think he's the one that's living his life. He is the one who's truly free because he isn't
the
going
way
to
it
be
reads
part of...
to me. Yes, the way it reads to me is that he. That they are trying to, that they are part of this resistance. They want to go in and they just want to like give people free electric care. They just want to like help people with their shit, right? And the government's like, no, that has to be monetized. You can't do that. You can't. And so they're like, well, we're going to keep doing it. So they keep going in and they keep helping people and they keep doing whatever they can do. And they're these sort of like resistance fighters, these heroes. But to keep the rich and all these other people like afraid. These bombs are blowing up, and they're going, look, it's
false
the Tuttles.
Flags.
Yes, and they're going, the Tuttles did that. The Tuttles did that.
It's sort of what's going on right now.
The illegals did it.
Movie.
Fentanyl in the candy. It's all this shit. And we're all going, fear. Like, well, what? It's
fear
fear-mongering.
Is control.
And so then.
Fear equals control.
When we see De Niro, and he's this really good dude, and he's like, no, I have nothing to do with that. I don't know what's happening. And we watch the government be so awful. We watch them take Buttle and kill him, and then like act like nothing happened. And then the people we meet from the government are like Hoskins and his toady who are awful.
I love,
you know,
yeah.
So we'll talk about him next, because the comparison between De Niro And Hoskins is the epitome of that. It's like, Hoskins is the terrorist. Hoskins is the one coming in and fucking up that dude's apartment and being like, fuck you, you can't even live here anymore. That's terrorism, right?
Yeah.
De Niro and I'm gonna bury you in bureaucracy. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway.
It's a great point.
Yeah, it's a good digression. Okay, Hoskins, I think we should talk about. Now, when this movie is billed, when you see, like, the Criterion edition, the Steelbook, like, all the new Blu-rays of it, the three names at the top are Jonathan Pryce, Bob Hoskins, Robert De Niro. Right. I personally don't think that that is correct, but I get it.
And certainly not at the time either. Like, yeah. Like, right. Hoskins...
Why wouldn't Ian Holm be on there? I feel like he has a bigger role than the other
That's what
guys.
I mean. It's like, I would put Holm above them. I would put Greist above them. I would put... I don't know.
Ian Holm Ian Holm, I guess, did Lord of the Rings, but Who's Afraid of Roger Rabbit was a phenomenon, and he was the star of Who's Afraid of Roger Rabbit. Yeah.
Yeah, but wasn't that after this?
It was after, but that's what I'm saying, is that what you're seeing is retro stuff. They're selling it now as a thing, because he didn't emerge at all. Like, this is right as his career is really starting. Bob Hoskins didn't gain any attention until later, and then he did like these type of parts, these kind of smaller parts where he's clearly stealing scenes, and
like
then
Smee. Like Smee?
No,
like Smee and Hook. I love his one of his Smee. Top roles. Yeah,
no. Yeah. I think it's important to counter that insanity with a movie he did called Mona Lisa Smiles, which was the one that sort of put him on the map as a critical thing. If you've never seen it, it is an amazing movie about a cab driver who drives a sex worker around London and their relationship. And it is, he is so different and so amazing. He's top notch.
Yeah, he had some really cool TV credit. He just did TV until he finally got something. But then he's in, like, some weird Brecht stuff, which is interesting.
Okay.
It's a TV movie called Brecht & Co.
Okay.
Where he was a member of Brecht's company. It was like a Brecht kind of movie about his time. And then he was also in the Beggar's Opera TV movie, which is interesting.
Yeah. All right.
But he's in Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Yes, he is.
He's the rock and roll manager. And he's also in The Long Good Friday, was a big early one for him. But then after that, you get Brazil. Well, Cotton Club, I don't think he's a huge part of that. But then Brazil is one where people go like, who's this character actor?
He's great.
I want to know him. And then he starts, he's in Mona Lisa in 1986. I think it's just called Mona Lisa.
Just Mona Lisa?
Be wrong. Yeah, Mona Lisa Smile is a Julia Roberts film that came out.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
Julia Roberts.
That's okay. That's right.
Who is his sidekick in this, and should I know him from somewhere? The guy that just kind of echoes the last half of his lines the whole time.
I believe that's the third writer guy. The third writer.
Okay.
There's a third writer that helped work it out, and I think that that's him. I could be mistaken, but...
He was just funny, and I was like, should I know this guy from somewhere?
I think his name is Derek O'Connor.
Uh-huh.
I think he's a writer. I'm going to click on his shit, and we're going to find out. Yeah. He wrote... Oh, no. He's in Lethal Weapon 2. He's in Daredevil.
Okay.
The movie. He's in Man from Reno, which I saw a screening of in 2014 where the director spoke, which was kind of cool. I don't know. He's in shit. He's in stuff. He's in Time Bandits. He's the leader of the robbers in Time Bandits.
All right.
Right.
Anyway, but he's interesting. He's good. Hoskins passes. I don't think you should, bill him as top billing here. But interesting.
No.
De Niro, similarly, is always top billed.
The more I see his younger role, he's fucking hot. Like, I would have
been. What are you talking about? Of course.
With him. Well, I've only ever seen older De Niro in the movies that came out, like, as I was growing up and stuff.
Taxi Driver.
He's hot as shit.
Fucking hot.
And he's like, this is at the top of his game. Like, how Gilliam got him.
Godfather 2.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. He's at a big point.
By this point, he's already got two Oscars,
Well, he's already done Mean Streets and Godfather Part 2 and Taxi Driver by now.
Sure.
And Raging Bull.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. And Deer Hunter. Shit. So the back half of the 70s, he's just slaying Puss. Yeah. He, New York, that was a horrible way to say it.
Slayer Puss.
He did New York, New York in 1977. He's in the TV miniseries of The Godfather, actually. The Godfather Saga. Deer Hunter, which, I mean, that's a top film, Deer Hunter. I fucking love it. I got to rewatch. I'm going to rewatch that.
My first
Raging
De Niro.
Bull, King of Comedy before
King of
this.
Comedy? Oh my God.
What my first De Niro movie? Was Great Expectations with Ethan Hawke and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. Wow.
That's old. I mean, that's old him. Like, that's not.
Oh yeah. I like him. That. Yeah, I've always seen him as an older guy.
It's like 98?
Was I that old? It's 98.
Yeah. He's in Midnight Run after the. Oh, before this, he's also in Once Upon a Time in America. In 84. Then he's in 85, he's in Brazil. So he's at the top of his game. And I think the story goes he asked Gilliam to be in a Gilliam film.
Oh, cool.
I could be wrong about that. But I think he was a Monty Python fan. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
And then he does Untouchables in 87. He's Al Capone.
Yeah.
In 87. He does Midnight Run in 88. He does... Oh my God, dude, I forgot how many movies this dude's in. We're No Angels, Stanley and Iris, Goodfellas in 90, Awakenings in 90. I didn't know those were both the same year.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cape Fear, 91. Bronx Tale, 93. Frankenstein as the frickin' monster in 94.
Huh.
Casino, 95. Okay.
And he's really good in that Frankenstein, which isn't a great flick.
Jackie Brown, his best performance.
he's awesome in Jackie Brown.
Yeah, he is awesome. Okay, De Niro, pass or fail?
Pass.
Yeah, he passes. There is one moment where somebody takes over as a stunt double that was like really obvious, and I was like,
that's not his fault.
Besides that, it was fun.
To me, he is the little glimmering light of hope in this film too. Like whenever he was on, I was like, oh, I can take a breath for a second because we're safe for a minute.
Yeah. Ian Holm.
Oh,
maybe my
fast.
VIP of the film.
Jack the Ripper himself.
Is that Bilbo. From hell? Is that what you're referencing?
From hell.
Okay.
He's Bilbo.
I can't not hear the Bilbo voice every time I hear him talk.
That's
I know
funny.
He is a storied, well, like traveled actor that has done a million things, but he's got a very notable voice. But he's fucking great in this.
He does.
Some
I
great shit. Like Alien.
Him.
Chariots of
Alien.
Fire.
I mean, Alien's the one for me. Yeah, that's what I know him from.
Oh, I came to love him because
he's also
of
Napoleon. Napoleon and Time Bandits.
He's Napoleon and Time Bandits. And there's an article I read. It was like he would say yes to anything that Terry would come to because there was a lot of projects that never happened because Terry was the one who would let him be funny.
Yeah.
He was a serious actor. He was Iceman Cometh. He was
right.
And he was like
Pinter. Yeah. I mean, he's
homecoming.
A Pinter acolyte.
Yeah. Pinter, and he was like,
fucking
he's
homecoming
like,
birthday party. Yeah.
And in Napoleon, when he's drunk and he's doing the monologue about
the
height of all these famous leaders. It's just
so
this
genius.
Thing. He's just like, you know, Alexander the Great was 5'7". I'm 5'1". And George Washington was 6'6". Like, he's just getting drunk, and then the Time Bandits are stealing all the shit. It's fucking
he's
great.
Also, he was, in 1978, they made a Les Mis TV movie, not the musical, but the
actual
story.
Novel.
Yeah.
And he was Thénardier, which totally works.
Perfect.
But
we stan a legend. I mean, come on. He's Lenny in The Homecoming. I mean, what can I don't know.
Yeah, legend. Pass.
Yeah.
Super pass.
Yeah. Super pass. I think he's my MVP of the movie. I love all of his anxiety
so
stuff.
Cowardly and
sycophantic. But also how the first time you meet him, he's coming out and like they're all so we have the people working in the office in this really hustle bustle office, this bureaucrat office where we don't really know what they do.
At some point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we can talk about it now. Where we you know, everything's moving around, everything's going crazy, and then anytime he closes the door, they're all watching TV.
A Western.
Later, they're watching Casablanca. at one point, I think it's just, like, slapstick comedy. But he's got this, like, he comes out and he's got that mean British Monty Python face where he's almost overacting, but you're just like, oh, no, he's just very posh and angry. And then he... when he's only with Jonathan Pryce and he turns into this like little like hand wringing fuddy duddy who's like, oh, I don't know what to do, and you're just it's good.
Lowry.
I think he's
Sam Lowry.
What did you want to say about that scene, Steve?
That scene was the first one that really caught me in this movie. How and it's the whole lead up It's they're just doing the lick of the opening to the Brazil song. And they're doing this long pan shot, or it's not a pan shot, it's just a continuous shot through the work floor all the way up to his office. And it is, you can tell it's so choreographed. It goes on forever and it looks amazing. And there's so many people involved with it. And I just admire it because I did an extended shot music video years ago and it took us 6 hours to get 5 takes of it. And that was with only 50 people.
Right.
So I can only imagine how much time they spent on that scene. And I was in as soon as that scene happened. I loved it.
And it keeps going. Like, and that's the other thing that we were commenting on while watching it is there's not a lick of digital in there. There's no computer generated nothing in that movie.
Right.
And so it's all practical, and the way that he creates depth and the way that he keeps focusing in and focusing out and moving the camera, like it's so dynamic. But pass. Me and Home is a pass.
Yeah, for sure. Pass.
Pass for sure. Okay, what about?
We should talk about the mom.
That's sure. next. Catherine Helmond, Mrs. Ida Lowry, with one of the best, like, prosthetic gags in a movie, probably ever. Definitely up until this point, and maybe even till now, when they're stretching out her face. Now, I don't know. Am I thinking of something else? I had this image burned in my head of her wearing like a rectangular contraption and her face being like pinned to
that
it.
That is the first episode of the new Doctor Who with Eccleston.
Right.
Because I thought of that too.
Yeah.
Okay. It's some rich lady from thousands of years ago and we're at the end of the world and her whole face is
That's what I'm thinking
hot.
Of.
Yeah. And yeah. that was what I immediately thought of when that
Okay, cool. Because I was like, doesn't that happen at some point where it just gets worse and worse and that's what it ends up being? But it's not that. But I still love it. It's so good. And
I wondered if that's where that first episode of Doctor Who got it.
Probably. Because that's something we should definitely get into at some point is like how many things reference this movie is
right.
quite profound. But she, I know her best. I watched a lot of like 80s, 90s television, but she was on Soap for a really long time.
So, and she was brilliant.
Did you watch Soap?
Oh yeah. It was the show that I had to sneak to watch because it was, I don't think like, again, dating myself, but that show shook people up, and it only was on for 2 or 3 seasons. But Billy Crystal played the first openly gay character on television, on American television.
Yeah.
And it was just brilliantly weird and in its own universe of, you know, it was a riff on soap operas, but then it was just like bizarre, like alien abductions. Like they just were weird with it.
And she's fantastic. She's also in, Who's the Boss?
Mona. Oh. Mona.
She's Mona. She's in a lot of Gilliam. She's in Time Bandits. She's the ogre's wife. She's in Fear and Loathing. She's like a clerk at one point, but she has like really great scene.
You know who she kind of reminds me of to a certain degree is, Jessica Walter, kind of playing like the hot mom, sipping drinks, always dressed to the nines. Like she reminded me of someone that could have voiced the mom on Archer.
Yeah,
interesting. I mean, and if you look at her IMDb, it's just coded, and she was on every single. I mean, it's fucking everything. Fantasy Island, you know, all of them. Bionic Woman.
but the one I
really remember is she's in Fairy Tale Theater, hosted by none other than Shelley Duvall. She's Jack's mother in Jack and the Beanstalk.
Right on.
I remember that really well. Yeah. Yeah, she's a big part of my childhood, weirdly. But that scene where they stretch out her face lives in my brain. Now, we didn't do context. I should say this. The first time I saw Brazil was... I skipped school with a friend who was a grade above me, and he was like, hey, let's go to my place. My parents are gone. Let's go to my place and get high and watch a really good movie. And I was like, cool, yeah, let's go. So we skipped school. We went for the afternoon, and we watched for my first time ever, I was like 14, I watched Old Boy. and it just like blows my mind. And I'm like, what did I just watch? And it's like absolutely insane. And he's like, you want to watch something else that's going to blow your mind? I was like, yes. He's like, great. And he put on Brazil. Mm. So like, it was like a big transformative movie experience for
wow,
me.
Wow. That's a hell
movies.
Of a day, dude.
Yeah, I bet.
That
is a hell of a day.
It is a hell of a day.
That's a hell of a day.
Yeah, so I really, really, like, have always loved this film and have wanted to study it more and stuff. But I'll be honest, this is maybe only the second, maybe third time I've seen it. So it was fun to revisit. I don't know where I was headed with that. I had a point. who's next? Michael Palin.
Ah. Michael Palin
from Monty Python
is maybe
Which
my.
One did he play?
He was Jack.
He's
he was
Jack. He's a friend who.
Yeah.
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 And he
was a cool character.
He's a really cool character. Palin is maybe my favorite Python because I think he was truly the best actor out of all of them. Like there are others that like Cleese could be funnier and all that, but Palin was the one. And when you see him like in A Fish Called Wanda. Or any of his other stuff. But in this one, especially the scene with... is this one of the triplets? Maybe.
Oh, I love that scene. That little girl was so fucking cute.
It's so weird. The little girl's awesome. And he's just like... and just the way he... because how else would you play somebody who's a torturer? You know, somebody who tortures some people for a living. You would, of course, be totally up.
Maybe
like
that
Steve
shot,
Martin in...
that shot of him with the baby mask at the end. So good.
Oh,
which
God.
Again, another thing that I immediately was like, is this a Doctor Who thing? Because it reminded me of Doctor Who, which
no, you
there's
can
so
see
many it. Things that I'm like, Doctor Who pulled from that movie in quite a
oh,
bit.
Oh yeah. I mean Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat, you know, were clearly devotees to Python and Gilliam and you know. And again, you know, this movie shook people up. Like people hadn't seen anything like this. They hadn't seen in a long time, I hadn't seen an artist and as director really sort of make a movie of this kind of extreme vision. It was, you know, of its time and place. It couldn't have existed in another time. But then, you know, we'll get into some of the influences later. But yeah.
A bit of trivia I always love to shout out, much like the very exciting Glenn Close appearance in Hook. There's in the movie The Witches, there are two really funny, there's one really funny cameo and then that both relates to Brazil. The Witches movie, I feel like has some of this Brazil DNA. It's got some Gilliam DNA in it. And it's just very British in general. But Michael Palin plays one of the witches.
He's
uncredited and he's just like in the mix of all the witches. And he, at one point, they give him like a really hardcore close up. And I always, as a kid, used to go, that's the guy from Monty Python. My brothers would go, no, it's not. They would make a bigger deal out of it. I was like, it has to be. It absolutely is. And then there's another person in this movie who is a witch in The Witches, Barbara Hicks. Who plays Mrs. Terrain, the one who keeps coming in with bandages. And she's like, oh, it's fine.
My complication had a complication. Great.
So good.
Oh.
And then she dies and they bring out her casket and it's covered in giant pink bows and shit. And you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
But she's great in this. She's a pass for me. She's really great.
Yeah, for sure.
She's also one of the witches who gets a lot of really great like close-ups and stuff. And she's a big-time character actress, has been in a thousand things. Some other people worth mentioning, Jim Broadbent.
Yeah,
he was the plastic surgeon. Yeah. And we should say about the plastic surgery, I think the movie does an interesting job of tackling the ridiculousness of the plastic surgery that they're doing without it being like shaming people who get plastic surgery. I mean, it kind of is, and I think you could watch it that way. But I do think, especially now, like I am somebody who is actually very pro whatever the fuck you want to do.
You got the money and it'll make you happy.
Especially like now that I've been so ingrained in the drag world for so long, like I see it where I'm like, yeah, that's your money. Like you gotta look like Cher. You gotta look like Cher. Like do you, right? So like I get it, but this movie doesn't ever feel like it's being like, look how fucking stupid these people are. It's just look at the lengths these people are going.
Right.
To.
It's the absurdity of it.
having been in the high-end skincare business for years out here, like, it's there's always another thing that they're coming up with that you can pay a lot of money for people to do to you.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Right. So, right. Yeah, and that this movie was made, what, almost 40 years ago? So, yeah.
But also, guys, don't get Botox until after you're, like, 35 or something. I don't know. I just know a lot of younger people.
That means I'm ready for Botox.
Go for it. I just know a lot of people in their 20s who are already getting it, so I'm just like, stop.
All the girls in my office were, like, 27, and they were getting regular Botox.
No, they're going to
I was the only one not getting Botox in that office.
Yeah, you don't need it. Nobody needs it. Peter Vaughn.
Moisturize.
Peter Vaughn from Game of Thrones. He's the old Targaryen who...
Oh, yeah, he's the head of the ministry.
Aemon
yes.
Targaryen.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's in this. He was good. He was interesting.
Yeah. Oh, my God. He's had Charles a career, McKellen. Too. Yeah, he's fantastic.
There's a lot of good... The woman who plays the mother... not the mother, but the...
The daughter?
The wife.
The wife of Miss Buttle.
Yes.
Sheila Reid. And then she, the rest of the time we see her as this sort of specter who's like screaming
for her. She looks familiar
husband.
Too.
She's great. She's been in a ton of stuff, but not a lot that I necessarily know. She's in like The Man Who Knew Too Little. And I was like, oh, okay, with Bill Murray. But nothing else. Everything else seems very British.
She's very, very stage. She's done a lot of stage and stuff. But her
she was the most grounded performance in the film, I thought.
And that's what gives it its weight, I think, is that there's the absurdity of this family having Christmas.
Well,
and then these...
Manic Pixie Dream Girl, too, I'd say.
Sure. Yeah, she's definitely. But that moment when, you know, he comes to deliver the refund check for her dead husband.
Yeah.
Like, which...
And she's just, like, frozen.
Oh, digression, but I just read this today about this. So one of the inspirations for the movie was... At one point, Gilliam had been doing a lot of research on the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects a Spanish Inquisition. And he found that at the time, they would bill people for their torture. So if they got somebody and tortured them, they would charge them. And if it took longer to extract information or get a confession or whatever, then the more money they would have to pay. And if they died, then they would try and make the family pay for
I heard back in the day you were expected to, like, tip your hangman.
Oh, wow. Weird. anyway, that was one of the influences. That's where that element comes from. It just the absurdity of a power structure so big that it would come in and go, yeah, we're gonna charge you for that. But we'll give you a refund, too, for the wrongful death.
I just found some solid information on the Robert De Niro stuff I was talking about earlier about how he got into this film. So De Niro went to Gilliam and said, I want to play Jack Lent, which is the part that Palin plays. The torturer. He was like, I want that part really badly. And he was like, oh, interesting. Okay, I've already cast it. It's Michael Palin. He's going to fucking kill it. But... there's this other part, and De Niro was like, I don't care, I just want to be in the movie, that sounds great. So he gave it to him, but then apparently they were very excited to have De Niro on set, but they had a lot of trouble working with him. So one thing that came up a lot was that he had like an extreme need and obsession for research and like understanding the world and like the details. He was like, but I need to know exactly why the government has decided to do this exact thing so that I can... And he was like, That's not the point. I want to strangle you.
Go home and do your own homework, De Niro.
Yeah. Gilliam's own quote is, I just wanted to strangle him the whole time. But despite all the issues they had, apparently, they've both said, no, I would definitely work with him again. And they just never
But they wouldn't
really
work
have.
With a leading female, huh? That's just...
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I don't think it was... I think at that time in Hollywood, they were deleting any actress that was quote-unquote difficult. Right.
Which makes me wonder how truly difficult.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But when it comes to De Niro, again, he's at the justifying anything that happened to her.
You get why they're kissing his feet. Because he was at the top of his game.
Correct. He's at the top of his game. He's begging to be in this. He's not casting it. He's asking for it. Right. And so, but then the other side of this, the part that they talked a lot about is that most of these actors would only need two or three takes, and they were all really prepared every day and really professional. Apparently, he was having to take 25 to 30 takes every time. He was having trouble with lines. Because it's like really difficult stuff he's having to say. Like, a lot of that shit is weird and like it doesn't flow out of the mouth.
It gets technical and
So he's forgetting lines. He's having all this trouble. So they decided, okay, we can't do this. They stopped filming. They ended up filming all of his shit separately with Jonathan Pryce, which is why you don't really see him with anybody else in the movie. and it took them 2 weeks to do it, and it was just them two. It was, they didn't do any other stuff during that 2 weeks. So apparently that was hardcore.
I wonder what Pryce has to say about working with De Niro. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that'd be interesting to find. Do you have any... Do y'all have any takes on why this movie is called Brazil?
I looked it up because I was curious, so I'll let
okay.
you answer.
Tell
There's
me.
several stories.
Well, that's what it's I was going to say. It's a myth, so I don't... Yeah, what did you look myth. Up? I would love to hear what you looked
up. I briefly looked it up on Wikipedia because one of my things was like, so why Brazil? And it said, well, it actually has nothing to do with the country. It has to do with the song. They really liked the song, so and they knew that the song was going to be a major part of the movie. What I read. But.
Yeah, no. And yeah, the thing that I read that seems to be the closest to reality was that Gilliam said that he saw some workers on a beach in Wales outside a power plant watching the sunset. And there was a weird random song playing that was a counterpoint to what he was seeing. And so I forget what that song was, but that song he kind of latched onto, and then they latched onto Brazil. It's a counterpoint. It's a dream. Brazil.
So the story I heard.
Yeah. Well, what I heard.
What I heard was is similar to that. Is that he was on the beach in the UK one day, and apparently the weather was like really bad and kind of stormy. And
UK
so
weather.
Everyone, yeah, so everyone was leaving, but there was a man sitting alone on the beach. Listening to Brazil, the song, on his stereo. And Gilliam was really fascinated by, like, the man being alone, listening to this really, like, happy, paradise-based song despite all the adversity surrounding him. And he was like, that's going to be the theme for the movie. So then when he was coming up with a name, he was like, well, call it the name of the song. Fuck it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is interesting. I love that. It does make you, though, when you're watching it, go like, okay, but why? You know, right. And I
was
and
waiting
I think
for someone
to
say it
deeper.
In the movie so I could go, ah.
Yeah, where's the titular line? Yeah.
And at one point, I think the production, at one point he wanted to call it 1984 and a half. Like
correct.
That was sort of
well,
the
Well, it was supposed to be a spoof of 1984 in some ways because in
it
he
was
trying
it
to be
a
like.
A lot of the major plot points
It was that and a riff
and a
on
Fellini.
Riff on Fellini, which.
Eight and a half. Yeah, the movie, the Federico Fellini movie mm-hmm. 8.5.
I was a 9 in college.
Were but you? Then the movie 1984 got released.
Right.
Yeah. And then they scrapped all of it because they were like, we can't do that. But, you know, there's some legal stuff with the Orwell estate and whatever. But it's interesting, CJ, that at the top you sort of say, like, it feels like a rehash. It is kind of, but really what he's doing is being like, yeah, but I'm spoofing this. Like, he's.
No, I mean, clearly it's a silly stacking
on
telling
top
of it.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah, he's really, I think, and this is where you can feel Stoppard come into it, is that it's 1984 is a very serious, analytical, philosophical look at a dystopian future and, you know, an authoritarian government and all that. This
yeah.
is too, but this is kind of going, isn't that fucking weirdly funny? Like, it's
yeah.
the absurdity of it.
You don't laugh, you're going to cry.
Yeah, yeah. And,
And the movie starts out with that absurd thing that makes all of the movie happen, which is the beetle falling into the typewriter thing,
yeah,
causing
the
typographical
the
mistake.
Yeah.
Apparently that was a Tom Stoppard idea,
huh?
Which is kind of cool. Gilliam fully credits that with Stoppard. He's like, Stoppard had that idea one day. We're like, oh, that's the inciting incident. Let's go.
Yeah.
It's just absurd enough. Just ridiculous enough to cause such horrifying things.
And random.
Usually,
and it's so random.
Which is usually
yeah.
the truth of most horrible yep. things that happen.
True.
Right. Yeah.
True.
It's just, you know.
Yeah.
Misids him. Yeah.
Also, De Niro apparently originally went uncredited in this film, which is another thing that I thought was interesting.
That's what
I kinda... A lot of people do that in his movies, where it's almost kind of like a cameo, like a
well, yeah,
reference.
You think, when I think about, like, well... Like Time Bandits.
Yeah,
like,
there's a lot
like
of people.
John Cleese shows up for one day
as,
he's
Robin,
like, we're
Hood,
gonna,
yeah.
as Robin Hood. We're going to shoot this today, and like,
yeah. it, or in Baron von Munchausen, Robin Williams plays the moon,
and is uncredited.
And is uncredited. No, he's credited as like something insane. It's like John Tuttle or something. Let me look. It's hilarious. I got it. Keep talking.
But yeah, he does that all the time. I think there was definitely a point in time where anybody was willing to work with him, you know. And we should also bring up, while you're looking that up, the whole Sarah Polley thing.
Right.
That is worth the rabbit hole. I don't know enough about it. And I don't want to get into it, but so Sarah Polley was a little girl in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and
right.
She's gone on to be a very successful actress and director.
And documentarian and director.
And writer. And so she reflected back at one point going, hey, you know what? I really feel like I was in an unsafe situation shooting that movie. And then she basically starts a dialogue via emails with Terry Gilliam talking about it. And I haven't done the deep dive into it, but it was a commentary on safety, on being a woman and a young woman in Hollywood and putting trust in these men. And she's also worked with Adam Egoyan and several other filmmakers over the years. And so anyway, it's worth pointing that out. And
yeah, for sure. He was credited as Ray D. Tuto, which is Italian for King of Everything, which is how he introduces himself in the film. And he just was in town and recorded like, it right after a flight.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Anyway, okay. What else about this movie is worth discussing? Because there's a lot. We could go really deep.
Oh, man.
The production design is definitely worth discussing.
Well, the final thing I had to say about it was it's incredibly theatrical, but so theatrical that I don't know that you could ever produce it on stage.
You'd have to have a fucking budget.
It's funny because...
And a turntable.
Bailey yeah. turned to me while watching it while you were asleep, CJ.
No, I remember hearing this conversation.
Going, oh,
with her eyes closed,
stage.
Yeah.
but yeah, it would be so enormous a thing to try and do. Like,
yeah.
And you'd never be able to beat that design work.
It would take a lot. You'd have to have a massive budget and people would have to really want to see it. But we should talk about that. The production design is absolutely insane. We called it, and I think this is maybe probably the only term for it, it's retro punk.
Yeah.
Right? It's like sci-fi.
Retro steampunk.
Retro steampunk. It's retro punk. It's like using sci-fi type stuff, but setting it in an older time. However, this was made in 85, so it's using the 80s technology and sort of updating it in this kind of weird punky, steampunky way. But to watch it now feels even weirder, like...
Yeah.
Like, because the stuff they're using is stuff we don't even think about anymore. Like, the plugging in the phones is retro to the 80s.
Right,
right?
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. Very interesting.
Well, yeah, and...
very Blade Runner, very...
All of that. Like
Andor.
Andor takes from it. You can see all... That was his gift. Was mm-hmm. as a career going back to his animation, and even if you go and like look at like his illustrations when he was working at the magazines and stuff, it's insane. And I talked about it earlier that he's going through these filters. He's a huge Fritz Lang German expressionism fan.
Right.
Man, you can absolutely
didn't we talk about
that.
Metropolis a little bit during?
Oh
this?
Yeah, I mean
yeah,
Metropolis,
oh, for sure.
You know, because
yeah.
he said you know he kind of takes Metropolis and then just dirties it up and kind of starts ripping off, you know, panels from buildings and walls and lets the wires come out of it. But then he's got like, he was very influenced by like Victorian illustrators. So you can see him pulling those images and like even the costumes Catherine's hat, you know, and
yeah.
being
shoe
a
hat.
Shoe hat, the shoe hat. And, but all of those things, you know, and the detail of it, like if you freeze any frame and you just start looking and you're like, holy shit, there's this little thing here, this little thing, like the whole contraption where he's opening up his, you know, making his breakfast and the, you know, the coffee's on spilling on the toast and
right.
all of that stuff. It's still jaw dropping. Like, you know, having seen it all those years ago for me, and still going, God damn, this is a fucking good, amazingly made film.
Well, everything is so computer generated now too. It's fun to see stuff that's practical, even back in the day when it was well done. I mean,
yeah,
I'm way more impressed with that stuff than I am with the computer generated stuff most of the time anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's also a huge Kurosawa fan, and you feel that with all the samurai stuff, with the sort of big bad at the end is this giant kind of samurai thing. And
We talked about the cool sets too, like the outside of Sam's work. Bailey, you were like, is that an actual place? It's like, it looks like the outside of like a temple, like in Rome or something.
Yeah, but then they blew it up. So I was like, I guess that's a set.
We discussed when they were like, when they had captured him at the end and they had him tied to the chair and they were getting ready to torture him. We talked about the fact that it looked like he was in the side of like a nuclear
smokestack. Yeah, it's amazing, and it's like, I guess it could have been matte paintings, but it feels really three dimensional. Like
it normally felt like a real place to me. Yeah, they built it. That's insane.
It had to have been some sort of industrial place that they found to do that.
Chernobyl, that was the year before Chernobyl happened.
So.
Can I tell y'all a kind of sad, interesting story that revolves around this movie?
Interesting story.
Correct. River Phoenix. This was his favorite movie.
Of course it was.
And he was making a movie in 2012 with Jonathan Pryce called Dark Blood.
Okay.
Or 2002, sorry. Called Dark Blood. And
wait, River Phoenix?
Yeah, it would have been before that then.
Yeah.
It says 2002 in this. That's wrong. But it was early. It was right before. It was right. The point of this is, it doesn't matter. Dark Blood, whatever this movie was, he was shooting with Jonathan Pryce. And Pryce had arranged for Phoenix to meet, for River, to meet Terry Gilliam, who apparently was his hero. And he really wanted to work with him. And the meeting was set to happen the day he died outside of the Viper Room.
No.
So Phoenix never met him.
Oh.
River never met him.
Drugs are bad sometimes.
Isn't that crazy?
Drugs are bad, yeah.
Yeah, so that's super sad. So I don't know what year River Phoenix passed, but...
It was 90s, right?
93. So it was
91 he was in Last
Crusade. 92 was the movie.
Partially written by Tom Stoppard.
That's right.
Okay, so, and we've done a whole miniseries on Stoppard, who co-wrote this, and you can go listen
with
to that.
Bonus material.
Is there anything else y'all want to say about the production design, about the thing? Scott, we had talked a little bit about, there are a lot of things that reference this nowadays. Do you have a list of any of those, or do you know them off the top of your head?
No, we talked about The Last Jedi.
Yep.
And all the Canto Bight stuff, and as you come into it, he literally had John Williams use the melody from Brazil. So dun, 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 as you come into Canto Bight for the first time. But all of that design work was inspired by him. Rian Johnson was a huge fan. You look at all of like Tim Burton's early stuff that happens after this. I mean, you look at the city of Gotham and the design of Gotham City.
Tim Burton's Gotham,
and those first two Batman. He's definitely, you know, seeing his stuff. Loki, all that stuff in the ministry and all of that.
Oh, that's cool as fuck. Okay, I can
clear
see that.
That's why I was so excited early on about that show. I'm like, they're riffing on cool shit. Like, they're taking... you know, deep cut stuff and riffing on it. So
let me list real quick a few of the things he's referencing, because he's referencing a ton of shit. We kind of already talked through a lot of it, but he's referencing Kagamusha, obviously. He's referencing Empire Strikes Back very heavily with that samurai scene, because remember, he kills the samurai and then the samurai has his face, which is right out of Empire Strikes Back, when Luke kills Vader for the first time in his dream. He's referencing Brewster McCloud, which had come out 15 years before. Do you know Brewster McCloud?
Yeah.
That's
sure.
A good film.
Yeah.
I like Brewster McCloud. I think it's interesting. But there's like the man flying on the mechanical wings in that one. He's got references to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He's got 8 and a Half, Metropolis. We've said all this. The Birdman, Casablanca. There's a 1944 movie called Brazil, apparently, that he references. But here are some things that reference this.
Mm-hmm.
You got Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Apparently, a security guard dies, and it's an exact death out of Brazil somehow.
Oh, wow.
The production design of Tim Burton's Batman is directly inspired by this. Good job, cool. Scott.
That was yes, a, thank you. Thank that. You.
Jacob's Ladder's production design is directly
inspired.
Oh,
yeah.
By this.
That's a crazy cool flick.
Crazy
similar
cool flick.
Kind of riffed at the end, too, like where you're not yeah. quite sure where the dream ends and reality begins kind of thing.
Absolutely. Oh, there nice. Is a fish or there's a Brazil poster in the video store in the Fisher King.
Ah, yes. I think I knew that. I did,
which I love. Hudsucker Proxy. I don't know
oh
if y'all
my
have
God.
Ever seen it.
Oh my
it's
God.
Sam Raimi Coen Brothers situation is one of the best Coen Brothers films in my opinion. It very much references this. City of Lost Children. Fargo has some Brazilian kind of Brazil type absurdity in it, and like jokes in it. Gattaca, and then obviously we talked about this last time, but The Matrix and what was the other? Oh, Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
Yeah,
Ryan Thomas Johnson. No, Ryan Johnson apparently is like a massive Brazil fan and used the theme Brazil as a theme in The Last Jedi, which is pretty rad.
Good.
Yeah, well, all that we talked about, yeah. It's amazing.
Yay.
Should yeah. I close it out? Are we...
What yeah, no, I'm sorry. I was distracted for a second trying to find my notes. But, yeah, just, again, it's not a happy film, but there's... It's a hell of a trip, like getting there, like and following the story, but just all the details, like the posters, all the posters in the background that you see, like suspicion breeds confidence. Loose talk is noose talk.
I love consumers for Christ.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Consumers for Christ. And don't suspect a friend. Report him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as we're coming into the Christmas, the holiday season, it's a Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas movie. It is. It all takes place.
It is absolutely a Christmas movie. Yeah. 100%. Much like Batman Returns, it actually has a very similar vibe to Batman Returns, Burton one, because it's Christmassy and it's cold and, you know, all that shit. Here's two really interesting references that I just read. In Lord of War, the 2005 Nick Cage movie, while talking to Ian Holm, Nick Cage offhandedly mentions a character named Kurtzman, which is the character that Holm plays in Brazil. Yeah. Very interesting. And then in the Simpsons movie, there's an epiphany scene and it gets visually referenced. I think Homer like flies away on wings or something like that. And then there's a few other really interesting, Death at the Funeral. And then South Park, Go God Go.
One of my favorite trilogies.
This is Go God Go. It looks like part 12.
Yeah.
And it says the cap Cartman wears when using the time phone is based on the caps worn by the engineers in the futuristic film.
Oh,
so,
fuck,
so it's
now I
those really long
that.
Bill.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Hoskins and the dude wear.
Love it.
Yeah. Anyway, did you enjoy this film, CJ?
Yeah, I did. I'm always glad to see shit that you guys talk about all the time.
Yeah.
Because
we reference this a lot. Yeah.
And y'all are just so much better versed at movies with me, so it's always fun to watch something you guys are excited about.
Right on.
I don't know that that's a good thing, though, CJ. It means that we've spent a lot of time sitting on our asses watching people tell us stories.
No, I admire it. Pictures. I wish I had a bigger brain for movies, and I know I could. I just got to keep watching them.
You got to work harder.
Keep watching
harder.
Them with us.
I got to work harder, I guess.
Well, next season, we're going to be doing a lot of in-stuffs because we're having kind of a different season. We're doing less playwrights, a lot of in-stuff. So we're going to get to probably watch a lot of movies and talk about a lot of weird
Great,
shit that
I'm in.
We reference all the time. Okay, cool. Is there anything else y'all want to discuss about Brazil, Gilliam, Stoppard, anything else before we get out of here?
No, I thank y'all for letting me show it to y'all and talk about it. And it's one of my faves and a lot of other people's too. So thank you.
Yeah. Yes. I really love this movie. It was really fun to talk about it with you guys. I'm sure we'll talk about it plenty more as we go. But do you guys have anything coming up in Los Angeles? Listeners, if you do, please send them to us. We would love to read them on the pod. But hey, CJ and Scott, you got any spitlets?
LA Spotlight.
Yeah,
LA Spotlight. Spotlight it.
James McQueen, amazing choreographer, dancer, and teacher, presents Reflect on Women December 16th and 17th at 7:30 at the Broadwater Second Stage. It features 8 choreographers for a night, so each show is different. Come both nights, y'all. Be on the lookout on the Sacred Fools website or the Facebook event with the Eventbrite link.
Awesome.
Yes.
Scott?
I don't have anything pressing at the moment, but I might have a cool announcement on the next one. Cool. So we'll see.
Cool. I got nothing. I had a meeting today with my director for Mothers of God, the script.
I can't wait to get into that script.
Yeah.
We have another reading coming up that we'll be doing soon, but we're not having audiences yet, so I can't spotlight it. But come to theater. Go see theater. Go see fucking theater, wherever you are, Los Angeles or otherwise, especially if you're in the Midwest or somewhere where theaters are probably struggling right now post-COVID to fill seats. Get in there. Go see some new works.
Do it.
Go see some fun little musicals. Community theater or otherwise. It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys, for joining us for theater and stuff, Brazil. Join us next week as we close out our season with what this will be our third curtain call.
Third curtain call.
So on our curtain calls, we kind of go back through the season. We talk about our favorite and stuffs. So we talk about our favorite plays and playwrights, and we rank them. We rank all of the plays. No, not all of them. We give our top 10
we
plays.
We rank the playwrights.
We rank the playwrights, and then we give our top 10 plays, right? That's what we're doing? So get your lists ready, and if you have them, send them in to us. We would love to read them.
Yeah.
If you're a listener, I'll read your top tens. I really will. And if you want to rank all of our playwrights from this season, I would love to read them. Why not? That would be super fun. So send in your rankings, and maybe we'll get some guests' rankings, too, just for fun.
Ooh, that's a great
idea. If they
idea.
Have them, I bet Travis has a ranking, and we'll ask around. Casper probably has a ranking.
I wonder who his number one is.
Well, yeah. We know Travis will pick Brecht number one for sure. Well, maybe not. We don't know. We don't know. But we'll find out and we'll let you know. And then after that, we always do at the end of the season, we're just going to have a little fun bonus mini series where we're going to do 3 whole episodes on Shakespeare's histories. We're starting with Richard.
No.
No. No. Henry Sorry. Six... We're starting with Henry the Sixth
Part
One.
Yeah.
Then Richard the Second, and then Henry the Fifth.
Yay.
That'll be super fun. We recorded way too long, y'all. This is such a long episode. I love you guys. That's all I have.
Do y'all want to know where to send in your top tens and your favorite plays that we discussed this year? Well, you can reach out to us via email. You can also get us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott.
Thank you so much, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson for writing our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
Yep. It's true.
He also does all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. Stick around because you'll hear our theme song, because it's our regular theme song that we close with, because this is an in stuff.
Yeah, bonus.
Yeah, it's true.
So
bonus
big shout
episode.
Out. Bonus episode. So big shout out to Pam Quinn, who wrote our special in stuff theme song. She's a frequent contributor and an amazing human being. We love her. And then finally, the great Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Annie Baker, who writes every single one of
CJ,
our episodes.
CJ, should we talk about the fact that...
We didn't talk about Tar. We're going to have to save it for the curtain call.
Oh, we'll save it for the curtain call.
Yeah,
Tar's a good movie. That's my take. All right, keep going.
And she doesn't...
Hey, Scott.
Annie Baker doesn't even know it. Yeah.
Did you guys hear that?
Go ahead.
And one day, Annie Baker, we're going to buy you a beer.
We sure are. Subscribe, rate, review. We freaking love you, dudes. We'll see you later. Brazil, go watch it if you haven't.
Do, 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 do.
No one's going to hurt you. No one's going to dare. Others can desert you. Not to worry, whistle, I'll be there. Demons will charm you with a smile. For a while, but in time, nothing can harm you, not while I'm around.
Later, everybody. Love ya.
The theater, the theater.
Hang out, Louis!
Theater, theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater, theater.